That, my friends, is the magnificent licorice of Eddie Daniels. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We have Eddie Daniels in the studio with us today. Eddie Daniels, welcome to WBAI.
Well, thank you, Armand. Great to
nice.
Be here.
What a surprise. What a treat to be here.
I know. We have a special relationship.
This goes a long back. Eddie Daniels is one of the finest tenor and clarinet saxophonists in the world and known the world over. And Kent Robert Shore is with us. Kent, how are you? I called Kent and I said, Kent, Eddie Daniels is coming over. He said, party, and he came rushing over.
Oh, yeah, you know, we're doing our creativity series, and Eddie Daniels, one of the great, great jazz people. Very pleasure to be here.
So, Eddie, just everybody must know you, but just let me give them a tiny, tiny bit more sample of this thing so they could have an idea of the kind of artistry we're dealing with. Perfection. Oh my gosh almighty. You got better. You got better. This is two albums ago, right?
Right.
What's the latest album called?
It's called Homecoming.
Homecoming, right.
You
did it at the Iridium, right?
Right.
And let me tell you the story, my friend. So a little recently I said, I think I'll go listen to some jazz. And I checked the jazz clubs, and there it was. Eddie Daniels was appearing at the Iridium, and I hadn't seen Eddie for 20 years.
Yeah.
Or so. And I said, of all things, to see Eddie Daniels. So there, Eddie will pick up the story from there. There he is standing in the bandstand, right, and ready to start his show, and...
And then this guy comes over to me, and he doesn't think I know who he is, so he flashes his card with his name. And because I'm blind, I can't see his name, but I know who he is.
But I don't have my mustache.
You don't have your mustache, that's right. But it's your eyes, Armand. Yeah, we know each other for a long, long time. When I talked about homecoming, since Mirabai and I live in New Mexico, and we've been there for 16 years, coming back to New York City, which we do on occasion, once a year at least, is like a homecoming, and doing the album at the Iridium last year on my birthday, I won't delineate which birthday it was really like coming home to being on those streets that I walked so many times. So I feel like they're my streets. I pounded that pavement since, you know, from the age of 11.
You're talking about the Broadway streets?
Yeah, the Broadway streets. Yeah.
Whatever happened to, I mean, what was there before the Iridium? Did the Iridium move right in?
Well, it was Birdland, but I don't know what was at the Iridium. The Iridium used to be up near Lincoln Center.
I remember, 67th Street or something.
Yeah.
And then it became, so Birdland is out.
Yeah, but the old Birdland is right around the corner, is right up the street. Mm-hmm.
The
original Birdland. It became the Hawaii Kai at one point, and now it's a strip joint, or it says, you know, for gentlemen. You know,
that club.
Yeah, that's Birdland.
Amazing.
That's where Miles got, you know, beat up by a cop on the
outside. Happened to Pee Wee?
That's a funny story, because Pee Wee, when the Hawaii Kai,
Pee Wee was the doorman. Everybody should know.
But he became the doorman at the Hawaii Kai after that.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, I know.
And didn't he become the? Didn't he introduce me? I think he's on a couple of albums.
Yeah,
you hear his voice. And now I want to introduce. Well, okay. Yeah. So the story is back then. So here you come back. Now you have been for as long as I've known you. So I mean, we could tell people the context of our relationship.
Okay, sure. All right? Absolutely.
All right. It wasn't intimate. It was as intimate as you could get. It was therapy. It was psychotherapy of the wildest kind. We were back in the 60s and we were doing, or 70s, and we were doing psychotherapy, and I was running groups and Eddie was part of it. And,
Around the time of the Janna of the Primal Scream, a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, about the same
exactly
time
right.
as that. And people in New York were trying to find something that would get them deeper into themselves other than how do you feel about this?
Yeah, how did you locate me? You found me through a friend, I think.
Probably.
Anyway, so you came by, and you were a perfectionist, are a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I know about you and your music, and it's always been. And you wanted to find a part of yourself. What part of yourself were you looking for? What'd you need?
Well, it's funny. I'll give you an answer you gave me ages ago at a session. I said, I want to find the root of neurosis. And you said, the root of neurosis is in, you know, it's in the jungles of South America.
Truly.
Now, well, you know, first of all, there's no perfection. There is no perfection, and there's no doing. You know, that's what I really feel. It's just that we feel that we're doing perfection. You can only go so far with how much you practice and the muscle memory and how much you teach your body to do. But when I do master classes and I work with people, you know, I realize we're not the doers. We try to whip our body into doing things that we want them to do. Either it's playing tennis, or it's learning a scale, or it's having a good tone. And you can do that only to a certain degree in terms of the kind of wiring you have in your body. And I have certain kind of wiring that will, at that age, caught a lot of the technique. It got the discipline of what I wanted to put in it. As I get older, I have to kind of reinforce that discipline. But when the music happens, when the actual happening of the music on stage with a band, you're not doing it anymore. It's just a flowing through. You're not the doer, you know. And I'm not sure we're ever the doer of anything. And that's kind of what I learned through the years, post Armand and post learning that there is no perfection. And if you try to be perfect, you can't be perfect. And there is, you know, and that there is no perfection, and that there's no me. So I don't know who you're talking to here.
Well, the no me is a big thing. You know, you're saying something. I was watching you last night at the Iridium, and you saw this remarkable drummer. What's his name again?
Louis Nash.
Louis Nash. Well, Louis Nash was, I looked at him and I said, you know, that's the feeling I had when I used to drum. Now, I don't mean I was as good as he was, but I had that feeling, you know, and that was the way he was kind of into his, like you were saying, it was coming through him, mm-hmm. and it was coming through you. And I don't see that in many musicians mm-hmm. nowadays. I do see the musicians doing.
That's right.
You know,
that's
they're right. doing, and they're not opening that way. So talk right. to me about how you prepare yourself for even standing up to do one piece. You're standing there off stage. You're saying, okay, now we're going to play Rickerbacker.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and then you stand up and what's that first moment like?
The very first moment of playing.
Yeah, the very first moment of it.
It's a nothing moment. You know, the hardest moment is, what am I going to play? And I put the set together. Then it's over because pretty much, you know, all the practicing that I've done in the 66 years that I've been around, I gave it away, it's in there. So I either have to trust, and I underline that, a zillion times that it's going to come out. And even when I'm nervous and I'm a little anxious of whether it'll come out or not, it's a part of me that does trust that it will. And even if I don't trust, there's nothing I can do about it. And so I put the set together, and there's a, you know, slight, I want to do the right set, and I'm hoping it all works. But as soon as I put the horn in my mouth and I hear the first note, it's okay. It doesn't matter. But, you know, you said, but that very moment before you play that note, it's something I did in a master class a couple of months ago that came up to me. It's almost as though, you know, when you see the cop car behind you with the red lights, and you get that little zits in your chest, the nervy buzz that you used to call ages ago. Do you still use that expression?
No,
but it's great. A very valuable expression of that very first moment. And people don't really realize it because, you know, in a symphony orchestra, the first clarinet has got 3,700 measures rest, and he has to come in on a high note, pianissimo, in the New York Philharmonic with 7,000 people watching. So, like, you know, he's pretty relaxed because for the first 100 measures, he's thinking about home, and he's figuring, he knows where he is in the piece because he's heard it 1,000 times. And as the measures get closer, the heart starts beating a little faster, and he knows that he has to have this moment. And there is a moment of the cop car flashing and the little hit in the chest, just as you're about to do it, and then you jump in the water. And then you either drown, you either sink or swim. And I think that's a valuable moment. And one of the things I was talking about in the masterclass is, of course, there were a whole bunch of musicians there, all my buddies who had played in the Philharmonic. I said, do we want to get rid of that moment when you have that little in the chest where you have to then just go, do it?
So that actually happens.
Oh,
it doesn't. It isn't a nothing moment.
Oh no.
I mean, it's nothing in the bigger sense.
Yeah, but yeah.
It's like you get up there and you have this kind of. I'm going to say it's kind of a pause, and the reason I'm going to say it's a pause, if this is accurate, and I'd like you to teach me because I never played professionally at the level that you did. It's like you get up there and the universe, well, everything is just now open, and you're going to maybe start, but it's not you. Do you lose yourself at that moment, or do you lose yourself later? When do you give up, I'm Eddie Daniels playing this piece?
The moment I hear the first note.
The first note. Okay.
Because I'm not sure there's going to be a first note. Okay. See, we never know. We never know if there's going to be a next breath or there's going to be anything. And I don't know if all that stuff that I crammed into my body is actually going to perform for me. Because wow. I can't do it. So that's always been the slight fear. And I think everybody has that fear. Do I know it's going to come out? Sure, I can go in a room and 10 times in a row hit a C scale and go, da 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 da. Okay, does that mean in front of 10,000 people or 1,000 or one person that I'll be able to go da 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 when I want to? It doesn't always mean that because it doesn't exist until it exists. It's only a thought before. I think about this a lot. It's only a concept before, and it only is real at the moment that it's really, really happening. So I don't know if it's really going to happen. And as soon as that first note happens, I go, oh, okay.
Now, when it is happening, and this is, we're talking with Eddie Daniels, by the way, clarinetist and alto and tenor saxophonist, in case you just tuned in. Eddie, once that first moment passes, and now the band is there, and now you've got that fantastic piano player. Oh, God, you can't. You're going to knock out, what's his
Tom
name?
Tom Rainier.
Tom Rainier tonight. Phew. Anyway, Tom Rainier, not for people listening, because tonight's going to be later. We're pre-recording this. But Tom Rainier, was he on your recording, by the way? He's on your latest recording.
Yeah.
So you've got this group, and you got a perfect group. They were perfect. Your bass was perfect. Your drum was perfect. Your piano was perfect. And because they're perfect, unlike the Sonny Rollins concert we saw where it wasn't perfect at the beginning, at that moment now, is it happening? Is Eddie happening? Is the world happening? Are you just like automatic? Are you on an automatic, Eddie? Is it, I think I'm going to do this. I think I'll try this riff. I think I'll do, Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening.
No, I just let the fingers go where they want to go. I have
to
keep my place in the music. I can't just go to sleep. I have to be alert, just like we're alert in our conversation right now. So I have to be aware of what's going on, and I'm following a thread in the music, and I'm not judging it, because if I start judging it, then I'm already behind the moment. I'm not in the moment. I'm in another moment. So I just kind of flow, and I'm loving the guys so much that they're so supportive and they're so great, and we're having so much fun together. I mean, David Fink said to me. He's one of the best bass players ever. He says, I'm going to be depressed on Monday.
Because you're not going to be playing with
them.
That's
right.
Right? You go back to California.
That's right, yeah. Go back to Santa Fe and the gig will be over. You know, but all of us kind of found this thing. We were all smiling. We're all having fun. Everybody's so happy. It's all of us playing together. And I'm loving everybody's playing as though it's all mine. It's all ours. It's, you know, it's a joyous experience.
Is that usually your experience with a band?
No, not all the time.
It's sometimes it's like you're just doing studio stuff. It's like everybody comes in like an alien and.
But it doesn't matter. I still have to, when I play my music and just go into the music, I have to kind of just surrender to it and just do what I do and listen to the sound and just kind of flow with the sound of the music. So it doesn't matter who I'm playing with. It really doesn't matter. It's always better when you have really, really great people with you who are your equals or better.
But you see, they've got to have that thing. And the thing is this humility that seems to allow you to access the universe.
That's right.
Now, I know I'm sounding very spiritual and I'm not, but I really mean it. I think the musicians that I admire and love and respect, they open themselves and the music kind of flows
in.
Yeah, like they're doorways.
Yeah, we're not doing it.
But if you've got to be the star, if you've got to be on top, if you've got to be... It's very hard.
I mean, Tom Rainier is writing the music for Dancing with the Stars in L.A.
Okay.
And he did American Idol. So all his week long, he's in the studio writing arrangements for Dancing with the Stars. And he comes out here of his own, He pays for his own hotel. He pays for his own air. Of course, we're good friends, and he says, I got to get away from that. He's loving doing it, of course, but he says, I can't wait to get to New York and just play with the guys, and we're going to have so much fun. And he's just said to me last night, I'm having such a good time. I'm loving it. So that's the kind of people I want to be around when I play, that they're not someone in the band who says, this gig doesn't pay enough, man, and, I'm unhappy. Everybody here, we're just all smiling at each other, and that's the key.
Do you have any feeling about the difference between playing with the older guys and the younger guys? I mean, the older pros that are around, you know, like let's say you get Roy Haynes, and I know you're not going to badmouth anybody.
No.
But I imagine if you get somebody, I think who's kind of later in their age.
Well, Hank Jones on the CD that you did with the opening, Getting Sentimental Over You. Hank Jones is 86 or 87. But we go back a long time. I was in Hank's band. When I was in Thad's band and I was 25, Hank would hire me and he was 40 or under 40. And I would go play with him and he was the leader. And so, you know, we have such a history, Hank and I. So, and he's such an artist, and he listens. And so the accent of the swing might be slightly different because he's older, but it's so beautiful and it's so artistic that it's timeless.
You know, just to give people a little example of what we're talking about, I'm going to play a very, very short piece to let you hear some of this beauty of the harmony of the group. And you're going to not like me because I'm going to cut it short at one point. But I want you to know we're talking about Eddie Daniels. And not Eddie Daniels. We're talking about the universe that Eddie Daniels lives in, that he brings by the studio here, and one that I've known for many, many years. Let me give you a taste of something great. And this is the very same pianist we're talking about.
Yeah.
Now, you see, this, I tell you, that's why you can't put on great music and take it down, because the audience will shoot me now. But, Eddie, while this is playing, you remember the moment of this being recorded, right? And just tell me, from what you're hearing, is there anything happening in here that's one of those moments? Because it was one of those moments in recording, you know? You're doing what with your bassist right now? Are you looking at him, or are you just feeling him?
No, he's in the room. Can't even see him.
He's very
far away on the other side of Clinton Studios on 11th Avenue and 50-something Street. I can maybe see his face, but I'm hearing him, and he's pretty queued up. But I'm looking at Hank, and Hank is just lays down the carpeting for me. And if you listen, the interplay between Hank and the harmony and the richness of it.
I like that. Hank is laying down the carpet, and you're walking on that carpet. Same drummer?
Same drum. No, different drummer.
Different
Kenny
drummer.
Washington.
Yeah. Well, Kent Robert Shaw. Kent, you've been around this world for a long time. What do you have to ask, Eddie?
Well, you know, I think, a lot, I always feel a lot of this relates to human behavior and psychology. And a lot of what you're saying, I think, about you know, working as a team, as a group, I think has a lot to do with people's general experiences at work, where, you know, a good jazz band seems to be, particularly I think the drummer, the bass, the pianist, if they're trying to get in the spotlight, they're going to step all over the soloist. And I think that that part of it, putting your ego aside, particularly the accompanying players, is one of the key things I notice. What I find difficult about some bands, where they're not allowing the group to really make the sound, as opposed to they're trying to get their own voices heard, which is stepping, particularly drummers, let's say, stepping on the soloist.
Well, at this level, you know, when you at least I have the. I'm lucky enough to be able to choose the guys I want, and they'll work for the amount of money that's being paid, which is not a lot. I'm just lucky that it's like my dad said, and he was a garment worker. He cut patterns on 37th Street and 8th Avenue. You know, he says, it's all your friends. No matter what you do in life, it's all relationships. I didn't understand what he meant. You know, I thought, you're kind of like, you know, you're just blowing it up my kazootie, you know. But it's really true.
Kazootie is acceptable.
Yeah, I knew that. But it's really true. It's how, you know, the guys respect your playing, but then they like you, and you like them. And you hang out with them, you have a cup of coffee together, and we talk about life, and we talk about other things, you know, and we talk about our relationships. And so it's really a fuller, deeper kind of thing. In fact, you know, Dave Fink, he's Jewish, I'm Jewish.
Bassist, Dave Fink.
Okay, David Fink, he's the bassist last night. He signs his email, Jew Bass. You know, and I sign a Jew clarinet when we, you know, and I know him for 45 years. So it's that kind of intimacy, you know, that that just we're laughing at each other and we're kind of nudging each other, you know, and kind of playing with that aspect of our, you know, our background.
Well, I thought part of the beauty of the world that I walked into, walking out of the Lower East Side of Manhattan and then joining the jazz world, was I found a family. And I found everything about music, about jazz music, to feel like family. Could you relate, Eddie, to the family you had compared to the family you get every time you play music?
Oh, it's much, it's the family I get when I play music is very different from, I'm walking on the, I heard my mother's voice. When I said to the people in the club last night, I've walked every step of this pavement. So I'll trip for a second. You know, on the pavement, and I say to Mirabai, and I put on my mother's voice, Edward, pick up your feet!
So you heard her voice everywhere.
Yeah, pick up your feet! You're throwing away money! What did you do? You paid that for that? You're throwing away money! You know, so it's just fun. I'm kind of playing with it. It's almost, I'm being with you. I'm here in the city. I'm hearing her voice, and she's gone. She died about 8 or 9 years ago, and we had her in Santa Fe at an assisted living, and then Alzheimer's unit, and we took care of her basically for about 10 to 15 years of having her around, and she was not an easy mother, as you know, from having you know me and knowing my mother through me well, in those early years. But we miss her, and we love her, because she was such a character. So, yes, that's a different kind of family. You know, your mother says, what are you doing? Why clean your room. What are you? You're wasting money. You're doing this. And you're playing with a piano player where you go, Favada, and he goes, beep, doo. The drummer goes, katika pop. And we're talking.
Right.
And nobody, there's no criticism. It's, we're cuddling each other.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you described who you don't want to work with, you described your mother.
That's right.
You know, so if a musician comes along who's like my mother, I'm.
That's right. That's
sorry.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Tell me a joke.
Let me tell you a joke.
Tell me a joke. Eddie, tell me a joke. He's got, Eddie is loaded.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I have to, it's. On the spur of the moment, it's very hard. What? Huh? After?
After.
That's,
after.
Oh,
go
okay.
Ahead. Good.
All right. Well, it's a joke. It's a story. I wrote a tune called That's for After, which we played on a gig. And the derivation of that title was, there was a, and I heard this in New York studios about 25 years ago. It was an old man. He's dying on his deathbed. And maybe his name is A.B. you know, and he worked in the garment district, and he's about to go. He's 87 years old, and he asked Jason, Jason, can I have some of Mom's chopped liver, please? I need it before I go. And you could hear the silverware down in the room, and the mom is preparing the table, and there's guests down there, and it's obviously he's going to be passing any minute, you know. And so Jason goes downstairs, and Abe's waiting. He's twiddling his thumbs. I got to have that last taste of that chopped liver before I go into the hereafter or the ever after or the liver after or I get delivered. So Jason comes back up empty-handed. Abe says, Jason, where's the chopped liver? And Jason says, Mom says that's for after.
And that's how you made the title.
That's how I made the title, based on After You've Gone.
The other aspect you were talking about is the perfectionism, and it seems to me like one of the challenges is a wish to play jazz to be perfect and like, but the other part, which is to be spontaneous and creative, which seems all about taking risks, and taking risks seems like you're going to make mistakes. So that seems like an internal battle. Like you want it to sound perfect, which would almost imply just go back to the old riffs, the old way you.
But sometimes
it.
The mistakes are better mm-hmm. than the real. And who's to say what a mistake is? Mm-hmm. In fact, on the record, on the new record, on That's for After, it's very fast tune. You'll hear it, Armand, when I give you a copy of it. Or I sell you a copy of it. Or we'll work it out. Anyway, so there's a point. It's probably some of the fastest, most furious playing that I have done. And there's one spot where I lose my place for a second. Mm-hmm. We're just hearing the drums, and there was a separation in the room, and I just kind of lost it, but came right back. And I was going to edit that out, and I decided I'm not editing that out. I want that in there because mm-hmm. that's who I am. I'm not trying to hide anything. Yeah. That's who I am. You know, there's another place where there's a squeak, you know. And when I go out and I do workshops and I work with students and I'm in front of sometimes 1,000 clarinetists, they say, how do you play on stage in front of all those audience? What do? I say, I allow 3 to 4 mistakes in every performance. It's built in. I allow it. It's a given before I even start. 3 or 4 mistakes. I'll even take 4. It's okay. So when you start out like that, you know, that kind of, there's no perfection. You're admitting that you're human, that stuff's going to happen. And especially as we get older, stuff happens. There's no doubt about it.
I remember a man who said, told a story about he was checking into a hotel with this woman he loves. And he said, but he got there a little early and he said to the hotel keeper, look, I'm looking for 3 things. He said, I'm looking for to check in early, I'm looking for an upgrade, and I'm looking for a pizza. He said, and you're allowed to disappoint me with 1. And he got the other 2, right? So they didn't give him the pizza. But, you know, I'm thinking about this in life. Imagine, Eddie, if everybody, and I'm gonna call this the Eddie Daniels approach, if everybody woke up and said, I'm allowing myself 4 mistakes today,
yeah.
4 mistakes. Yesterday I got in a taxi cab driver took me 20 blocks out of the way to get to 2 blocks. He made a mistake and I was all steaming for a minute.
Yeah.
Later when he got there, he was all upset. I was all upset because he was upset for having made the mistake. I said, thanks for the ride. I gave him a tip and he looked at me and he said, thanks for being nice.
Huh.
You know, because his mistake was making the mistake and my mistake was reacting to his mistake as if there was something that it was almost personal.
Right.
If we allow ourselves 4, what do you think? You think the rule is 4?
Yeah, 3. I think 4 is a good one, you know.
The 4 mistakes, this is going to be the title of a song, by the way. There's going to be a tune written called The 4 Mistakes of Eddie Daniels, right? 4 mistakes a day. If I can make 4, do you make 4 mistakes? Yeah,
I make 4 an hour, so I
you know, I have a good buddy, a good friend of mine, Dick Waller, who played principal clarinet in the Cincinnati Orchestra for 35 years. He's kind of a great friend, and he's a guru of a type. He's so smart, you know, not literally a guru, but his definition of happiness is H equals R divided by E. Happiness equals reality divided by expectations.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice. Hey, this is Armand Miller. We got to take a short break. It is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Walk on this carpet. Thank you. the very smooth and perfect tones. Eddie Daniels. Eddie Daniels in the studio with us, with Kent Robert Shaw. So, Kent and Eddie, welcome back here. And here we are at WBAI, and if people want to know how they can hear more of that, I could let them know the name of that last album was called The Eddie Daniels Quartet. And that's with Hank Jones on piano and Richie Davis on bass and Kenny Washington on drums.
It's actually called Mean What You Say.
What's Mean What You Say?
Is the title.
Oh, Mean What You Say. I see it. That's right. It's right on top. Mean What You Say. And the name of the new album, Eddie?
Homecoming.
Homecoming, right, which is recorded at the Iridium. Yeah.
Same label, IPO.
IPO. Okay, so Kent, you were saying...
Well, I think, again, all this, you know, this lack of perfectionism and all this humility is just so much a trait as a therapist that we're trying to, you know, get all people to connect with, because so many of the things about getting your ego out of the way in terms of working with other people that we talked about and playing a jazz band, but just as importantly, just allowing yourself to be human and frees you up from all the depression and self-hatred of not leading, you know, a perfect life and not having these expectations that are you're constantly being disappointed with.
Yeah, but I think a lot of the people that I know who don't have passionate artistic endeavors don't know what it's like to strive for perfection. You know, when you go to the office and you do your job, a lot of people go do their jobs and they're doing the best they can. But in an art form, I play tennis. In a sport, that striving for perfection is also so important in keeping that goal-oriented, going for it. And, of course, without that, you know, because I know a lot of musicians who never strived or strove for perfection, and they sound like it. You know, they're so they're so loose, but they're not that, you know, they don't have the discipline.
The discipline, yeah.
I mean, well, I'll give you a funny story. I mean, Zoot Simmons is one of my favorite guys. He was probably one of the ones who didn't have to practice too much. But he really was so talented and so great. So, you know, he drank a lot. So a lot of people say, hey, Zoot, how did you play and how did you play when you were drunk? He said, I practiced drunk.
Practiced drunk.
But anyway, so that was his discipline, but I'm just joking. You know, having a discipline, having that thing to work so hard for and maybe miss it, but then get up the next day. I want to get it. I got to go for it. That is so important, so that sometimes you may be jumping the gun by telling them, forget about perfection. You know, they need at least in some form. And I like tennis because that's another one where I'm on the court and I'm taking it. I take 1 to 2 private lessons with a pro every week. And then I'm on the court hitting with guys that kick my butt all the time. And I get frustrated, but then I go back and I want to do it more. So if you don't have that where you want to do it more, I want to get it better, I want to, and you have nothing, I can't imagine life without that desire.
Wow, that's a big statement. Without the desire to get it more perfect, to get it more right, I could never imagine a moment in my life when I'm trying to think of times. You know, it's almost a description of depression. You almost have there a description of depression, the absence of the desire to get it perfect. We can't call it anhedonia. Anhedonia is pleasure, right, Kent? What do we have? We got a word here where you're missing striving. It's Anna striving, right? You know?
Complacency like or that. Something.
Yeah, because something gets lost. You get that. It's so easy to get that way, especially when you're sloppy, especially when you're down under.
Right.
When you're down under and you're depressed and you just give up, there's nothing to strive for. If you strive for growing a flower, if you strive for tilling your garden, you know, or whatever it is you're doing, you know, I think a lot of people put that energy into exercise. I think the gyms may be the place that people are doing it. Trouble with it is you don't get much. It's kind of internal. You know what I mean? It's all the exercise thing is all kind of you inside you, and it doesn't really go out very far. What do you think?
But Kate? I think part of the, you know, the striving to be as best and challenge yourself as best as you can is a very good part of self-esteem and self-actualization and self-efficacy, you know, to set goals. I think the dark side is one thing we talked about in terms of ego, and it's all about fueling this sense of I'm the best and superiority. And I hope also the other dark side of it that people watch out for is the competitiveness. Like, I'm a better musician. I'm a better tennis player. So, again, if it's kind of an internal sort of struggle that people have and it doesn't get to a sort of darkness in terms of like feeling better than other people or a certain competitiveness or certainly a darkness in terms of competitiveness and just allowing people to have their own journey and their own level of how hard they want to struggle as opposed to, you know, having judgments of people who are less competitive or less, less perfectionistic.
Eddie, who would you say is your good point, Kent? Kent Robertshaw, by the way. Who would you say, you know, when you talk about influences, I know it's almost boring to talk about influences, but where would you say your influences came from? Who was your first tenor you heard? We had Sonny Rollins on, and he was amazing where he first...
You mean musical influences?
Yeah, yeah. Well, who
was
Sonny Rollins?
I think it was Louis Jordan.
Louis Jordan was, yeah. Was Sonny Rollins' first introduction, you know?
Well, but I would say Benny Goodman, you know, yeah, early on, Stan Getz, Coltrane, Charlie Parker, you know, Bill Evans at the piano. I mean, so many influences. And then you.
But wait,
I mean, but I'm saying you. You. Not you personally, but some of the process you put me through helped loosen up all of that stuff with all of those people. You know, where I didn't have to, I did an album called Under the Influence for, it's not out anymore, it was on GRP, and where I gave a tip my hat to Stan Getz, and I played a little bit of my Stan Getz feeling, some to Sonny and to Coltrane, but I never tried to actually imitate any of those guys into,
right.
in that kind of perfection where I had to be them to be as good as them. I just kind of like, this is who I love, my sound is in there, I'll just kind of be it, and, so that, you know, I got more, that kind of feeling where I didn't have to literally be great or be the best anymore. Maybe that's it. I don't have to be the best anymore because I am the best. But that's aside. No, it's okay.
You said an interesting thing. You said Bill Evans.
Yeah.
Now this most people, they wouldn't imagine, well, we didn't know Bill Evans played clarinet.
Well, he played music and he played from the heart. And he was another one that I kind of...
I know, I want to talk about the difference about how a different instrument influences
right,
you.
Right,
Bill Evans plays piano.
Yeah.
More than plays piano. He's a creative genius, right?
Right.
How did Bill Evans affect you? There you are playing. Why aren't you listening to how he plays? What are you getting out of it?
Well, what I got out of it back then, I used to come back from playing a wedding, a bar mitzvah, on a Sunday or a Saturday, and he was playing at the Vanguard, and he'd invite me to come in and sit in with him. So I came with my tuxedo from a wedding, from strolling the tables and playing Song of the Flame. Da, 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 you know, in the tuxedo, to walking into the Vanguard and sitting down and playing maybe a Solar with Bill Evans.
You know? Wow.
And that was, I was so grateful that he would let me do that. But he also would criticize me, because one time I sat in with him, And I played the tenor, and I was like so excited, you know, I'm really burning. And he says, and thank you everybody, that was Eddie Daniels with a number 147 read. That was his way of saying the energetic, over the top Eddie Daniels. And so now I feel like, you know, sometimes you need aging to kind of take the rough edges off of that over the topness. And go to your softer place, too. Mm-hmm. So, but Bill had that soft, just such a, you know, when you, he could just play one note and he pulled you into it.
And you do that.
Yeah.
Or if you've done that, classical music, any influences? Any influences from any other than jazz?
From any other than clarinetists?
Yeah, other than clarinetists.
Yeah, because most clarinetists, you know, there are not that many really solo clarinetists that I like them all, but not ones that I'd say I want to copy or I want to emulate. But they all play great. You know, I try to take things from all of them.
Why did you go from, like, I want to go, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but when I knew you, you were a tenor saxophonist, right? Played clarinet occasionally. Then you went on to switch to clarinet almost completely, and now you're back to tenor. Could you tell us about that?
Well, that's interesting also because, you know, I was in Thad Jones's band. I was the tenor, and Joe Henderson was the other tenor at one point. You know, Joe Farrell was the other tenor at one point. I was in the original band, and Joe Farrell was the first tenor player before Joe Henderson became the tenor player. And at some point, and Michael Brecker came along, he'd come into the Vanguard and show me a solo of mine that he took off a record. And but then those guys were getting so good, and I just loved how they played the tenor, and I thought, they're too good. I can't compete with that. But I said, on the clarinet, I think I have a voice that no one can do. That where I don't have to feel a competitiveness. There were 20 great tenor players. There was nobody playing the clarinet at the time other than Buddy DeFranco, who was a mentor to me.
Oh, good. I was going to mention him a minute ago. Yeah. Just listening to some of his... He did a Hare Krishna. Did you ever hear of Hare Krishna?
No.
Oh, it's fantastic.
You're talking Tony Scott, maybe.
Oh, Tony Scott did that.
Zen,
I'm sorry. Buddy DeFranco.
Yeah, yeah.
He did Zen meditation, and Tony DeFranco did music for a...
Yeah.
I know, I have it around.
But I felt that the clarinet was my... Getting more to my feminine side and not that over-the-top tenor trying to scream and do that high energy. And so I, you know, and for, so for years, and it also, it's a discipline instrument. You see, saxophone's not such a discipline instrument. That's the problem with a lot of the jazz. Well, for Wynton Marsalis, he's a great trumpet player, and there's the discipline of the legit trumpet and the technique of the trumpet, and he's gone through that. So he's a disciplined, practicing, wonderful player. On the saxophone, it's hard to have a discipline other than working through the changes and playing jazz as a discipline. But the clarinet has the heritage of the Brahms Quintet, the Mozart Quintet, all the Weber Concertos, the Mozart Concerto, the Nielsen Concerto. So I have that during the day to work on how I put my fingers down on the instrument, how the air goes through, and the beauty of the sound. So I always have that thing that I was talking about, that something to work for that is a discipline on that day. And so that really, and I went back to Juilliard to get a master's in clarinet, in classical clarinet playing, whatever that means. And so that became my voice, and it seemed to be an easier one to get, to define myself, which is maybe now I'm, sometimes you get locked in that definition, because now people hear me play the saxophone, and they say, I didn't know he even played the saxophone, because they grew up hearing Eddie Daniels when they were younger. I went to a repairman here in town, Mike, to have my horn fixed.
Relationship in your life.
Well, I think I've always had a loving relationship. I can't be without a loving relationship. I think my relationship with Mirabai is probably the most important one, because it's here and it's lasted the longest. We're together for 25 years. We're married coming on 8 years, so we dated for a long time. We lived together for a long time. There's a depth to going through all the stuff you have to do in a relationship and holding in there and going through it and coming out the other side and feeling love again after you feel hate.
That's important.
The hardest one. That's the hardest thing for a guy like me, for men. You know, once you get pissed off and, you know, and so... How do you, like, turn that corner and be able to feel loving right away? I can't right away. I need my little settling down time. But I think with working it through, with some of the therapy we did together in Santa Fe with Fred Altenhaus, where Fred would make me listen to what she had to say and hold me down and say, shut up, Eddie, you can't talk now. And hold me down. You're not talking, you're listening. And somehow, when she's laughing, and she had to do the same thing. Somehow I came out of that, the loving feelings come back after you have that, because you hear how someone else really feels.
Well, you're saying the same way you described, so I'm hearing three things now. I'm hearing that one thing is you described your music as being a flow that comes from, very often comes from a practice. Sometimes you have to go through the hard times,
right.
Got to make three or four mistakes, like being in a relationship and having fights,
yeah.
And then you get through it to a higher level,
right.
Is what you're saying. And you're saying you see relationships the same way, rough spots.
Right.
Rough spots are just rough spots.
That's right.
You work them through, and you go on to your next level.
Right.
And that working through the rough spots, you're saying, actually work for you.
Right.
Unless you have somebody with whom you don't want to work through the rough spots,
right.
Like your mother.
Right.
Then you don't hire her.
That's
in
right.
The band.
She's not playing drums in my band ever.
So Mirabai now. Mirabai is the name of a person. I want to introduce people to Mirabai for just a moment. Mirabai is also a singer. And he's part of the voice that Eddie Daniels lives with.
The clear bead at the center changes everything. There are no edges to my loving now. The clear bead at the center changes everything. There are no
It's going to take some time. We're going to have to go through this one. Mirabee, I know you're... welcome to WBAI, Mirabee, by the way. Your mic is open. Say hello.
Hello.
Hello. Mirabee. I'm sorry. Mirabee, so you met Eddie 15 years ago. You met me 15. You met me, 25 years ago.
Yes. Yeah, 24 maybe, I don't know.
Your music is dedicated to, what is it, your music? How would you describe it?
This music is the is musical settings of the poetry of Rumi and Hafez and my namesake Mirabai from India. And I loved, when I started hearing the poetry of Rumi, I was so moved by it. That's what I wanted to sing, and not what I call kind of, some of the old standards have slightly dysfunctional lyrics, but the love, you know, I'm nothing without you, baby. If you leave me, I'm going to die. I got tired of singing that. So this one, the clear bead at the center, changes everything.
The name of the album is This Love with Mirabee. So... you two ever worked together?
Eddie? Yes, we have, yeah.
What do you do?
We met when Eddie came to Columbus, Ohio to play with the big band I was singing with.
Yeah, and we shared our trying to get away from coffee, so we had our coffee substitutes.
Yeah, and now we drink coffee.
And I had my Rajneesh tapes, which you kind of influenced me on back then, you know, and I had all these tapes. I said, you got to hear the tapes of this guy. And little I know, she was like way deeper than I even thought I could go towards. And she was studying Rumi and singing all of this deep stuff. And, you know, I thought I was a knock-or.
Mirabee, This Love, by the way, Mirabee and I will do another interview, and we'll do that by telephone as soon as you get back, you know. But Mirabee, one thing about the influence of, what could you say as an observer of Eddie the musician as the technician, as the guy playing, what did you see evolve? How did you see it evolve? Was it, would you say it was more one thing? He became more mental, he became more spiritual. What did he become more of? What did you see over these 25 years?
I saw his heart open more and more in the music. Eddie's always had amazing technique, and always like moved me with his playing. But over the years, as he's grown, I feel like there's layers of depth that he goes deeper and deeper into the music, and I hear his heart, which, you know, it moves me now. Then, and now I'm spoiled. I can't hardly listen at all to any other clarinet players, I have to say.
I'll check it in the mail.
Well, I'm wondering if that's like an intellectual thing to have a lot of technique, but then it's much more, you know, the feelings part is much more soulful, you know, like a masculine intellectual technical ability, whereas a much more softer, more emotional aspect of
Well, I think Eddie's always been emotional. Mm-hmm. And his playing has always had a lot of emotion. A lot of people, you think, you know, a lot of technique would be very mental, but I never heard him as a really mental, intellectual player. Mm-hmm. He's always had a lot of feeling, but there's a softness, there's a deeper heart that mm-hmm. I feel in his music now.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I've heard every great musician go to stay great, mm-hmm. you know, except Lucky Thompson. Did you hear about Lucky Thompson?
I used to love his playing.
Have you seen him ever?
No. Is he still around?
Lost and homeless on the West Coast.
Oh, God.
And won't let anybody go near him.
Oh.
I know, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Funny thing, but of course you take somebody like Lucky Thompson, who when he played. I mean, you know, on the Walken album. I mean, it was like over the top greatness, and he and softness must have been a threat. Mm. You know? I bet I'm going to get sued by the Lucky Thompson Foundation.
I'm going to ask Tom Rainier, because Tom is from the coast and he knows everybody in LA. Yeah. So Tom can open that up for me a little bit.
And the difference is that there's a chance that you get a chance as a person to strike for your heart or to strike for your pocket, and you know, sometimes they go in opposite directions. Mm-hmm. What about money? Tell me how money has influenced you.
You know, I just picked, when you said that, at one of our sessions, you took a $5 bill and you burnt it.
Oh, I remember.
And you gave me the corner of it.
To remember.
To remember, and I put it in my wallet.
It was your $5 bill.
It was?
It was
and
your
And I cried.
It was your $5 bill. Were complaining about money, and I showed you the value of it. I thought about doing it for myself later, but I changed my mind.
No, money, it's changed. I think it's changed a lot.
Because what's the significance of a burned $5 bill?
Yeah, you got to get new ones.
And we're talking about back when $5 meant a lot more than
That's
it does
true.
Now.
That's true.
When it was a difference, when it made a real difference.
Well, I think we have to find out for ourselves what is the important thing for me or us. What is really the most important thing? You know, wanting money is anxiety. It's a kind of anxiety. So, you know, for me right now, what I'm working on is just the little anxieties that come up. What is it? You know, kind of working with it in different ways. I don't have to get into it now, but more important, the anxiety about money than the money itself.
Could you talk to me about anger? What happens to your rage when you feel rageful and angry?
When it's over the top, sometimes I go in the car and I'll scream. Mm-hmm. I'll still use that once in a while when it's over the top. But I really, sometimes I can just go to breathe. Just breathe.
Breathe because you've trained yourself to kind of cool yourself down.
Breathe, or I'll ask myself, who is it that's angry?
And what does that mean?
I try to find. Where is the location of the locus of who I think this is that is angry? And if I do that, who's doing that, I realize that there is no one there that I can really locate that really is anger. There is anger, no doubt, but I can't find who it is or what it is or where the source of it is. It's generalized in a kind of outspurting quality. But that's one of the ways. I'll just kind of ask, who is it that's angry? Who is it? Where is it?
And it doesn't bother you. When you feel angry, you kind of take it and you don't believe it very much. You're kind of saying, oh, I don't believe this.
Believe it. I believe what it does in the wiring of my body and how my body reacts to anger. But since we live in Santa Fe, I don't get angry that much.
Well, what do you think the difference is? What's the difference in living in Santa Fe? No, seriously.
Well, it's kind of the design of my life. I play music. I practice. I'm loving the music. I get a little angry at myself or annoyed at myself for having lost a tennis match and blown a point. And then just kind of accept it. I don't get angry in the way that I used to get angry. It's a little bit different. There's anger, you know, but I don't know. What would you say, Mirabai? I don't know. You've watched me enough.
Well, I think part of it is that when you start seeing that that anger arises, and you don't have to say it's my anger. You know, that's kind of an extension of what you were saying before. But of just saying these are angry feelings that are coming up, if you take it personally, if you identify with it, this is my anger, and hold on to it, then they expand. But if you know that it's just a feeling coming up and it's going to pass,
or accepting it,
right?
You know, why even try to get rid of it?
Right.
What's wrong with it?
Yeah, kind of the perfectionism. One of the perfectionisms I think people need to let go of is never getting angry. You know, that's like godlike or Christlike.
It's just one of those mistakes you got to allow yourself.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
You get angry. Listen, my friends, we have to get going. My special guest, Eddie Daniels and Mirabai, both will be back, and keep your eyes open. The album. The two albums, Mean What You Say, and the new one is
Homecoming.
Homecoming. And thanks for being here, Guy.
Great.
Good to see you. Good to see you, Maravai, right? Coincidentally, Ken Robert Shaw, as usual, And be back with you soon, my friends. You can get a copy of this recording, by the way. If you want to hear it, go to the website, thepositivemind.com, and you could just download it on your iPod, and you could hear this beautiful thing.
How about a war story? How about a war story? Thank you.